makes me sick when I see quote-unquote Bitcoiners cheer for a politician. This whole thing is to allow us to not let these parasites rule our lives anymore. It's always directionally correct to give less of a fuck about what politicians say. You had the impossible choice of a socialist woman or a crony capitalist man. And yeah, the crony capitalist is probably the least worst choice.
Yeah,
but he's still going to shitcoin and he's still going to screw you over, but he might leave you alone a bit more. I'd prefer if we didn't have to care about people who take our stuff at all.
How does a Bitcoin transform people from voting cattle sludge into sovereign individuals?
The ignorant masses. When people become dependent on the government for their own survival, which more and more people do as the government grows like a cancer tumor, you are unlikely to vote against your livelihood. Bitcoin gives you the optionality to get out of all that and become a sovereign individual instead. Bitcoin as a parasite is a parasite to kill all the other parasites.
Down a rabbit hole. Down. Cypherpunk.
Welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunk. This is episode 7 in our Infinity series, and I'm here with Knuts von Holm. Today, we're going to talk about symbiosis. What a cool word.
Yeah, symbiosis. And you're here with Penny and me.
Yeah. You guys are forming a symbiotic relationship.
We are.
Mutual cuddles.
Symbiosis. Is this the chapter that talks about the Venom movie?
Yes. You go into Venom, the alien, the symbiotic relationship.
It's not my favorite chapter of this book. Like, in hindsight, it's a bit far-fetched, maybe.
Well, it's an interesting thought.
So the idea is that Bitcoin is a symbiote, the same way that the symbiote in the Venom movies is Eddie Brock's symbiote. So it becomes a part of you and gives you superpowers, basically.
What superpowers does it give us?
It lowers our time preference and makes us better human beings, and it protects us and gives us peace of mind because we know our funds are safe for a long time, and therefore we dare to do shit we haven't done before. Like growing a beard and talking about Bitcoin on strange podcasts and flying all over the world to do so.
Oh my goodness. Voting cattle sludge. That's a term you use in this chapter. How does a Bitcoin transform people from voting cattle sludge into sovereign individuals?
Yeah, voting cattle sludge. That's like the ignorant masses. I mean, government handouts, and when people become dependent on the government for their own survival, which more and more people do as the government grows like a cancer tumor, you are unlikely to vote against your livelihood. So if you're a public sector employee, you like taxes because you're funded by taxes. And Bitcoin gives you the optionality to get out of all that and become a sovereign individual instead. I guess that's the main thesis there.
There's a famous quote that's something along the lines of, you can always depend on the vote of Peter when it's when he's taking money from Paul or something like that. Can you look at that quote? I think that's a... kind of describes this. I know. I think Dominic Frisbee had this quote.
I like asking the really simple questions, right? So one of my favorite questions to ask to normies is, why do people in the public sector pay taxes? What's the reason? Because they're funded by taxes. So why are they paying taxes?
Yeah.
And the only reason is to fool other taxpayers that they are as much of an asset as the other taxpayer is.
A government which robs Peter to pay Paul can always depend on the support of Paul.
Yeah. So that's a great quote.
Yeah, it's a great quote. It just describes.
And this is, it's also like why collectivists win elections from the simple fact that if you care more about belonging to a certain group, then you care about what that group thinks. then you form larger groups.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a political party is is big because it consists of people who don't care what the actual politics are, but care more about belonging to the group. That will always form the bigger group, which is an inherent flaw of democracy itself.
It's a fascinating thought.
Yeah.
It's like a hijacking of our evolutionary psychology, right? Because part of humanity for so many hundreds of thousands of years potentially was this idea of belonging to this group, being a part of the group. So it's still, as we've grown these massive nation states, that whole idea has been hijacked into the human psyche to be part of these large nation state groups in essence.
Yeah, there's something called Dunbar's number.
Dunbar's number, yeah.
And it's the largest amount of people that you can actually personally know,
mm-hmm.
and it's around 150 people.
Uh-huh.
And this tribes of chimpanzees or bonobos, they never grow bigger than this number.
Yeah.
And for the simple reason that they don't have language. Because when you have language, like human beings, we can have intersubjective ideas that can propagate over bigger groups than that. So that's how religions and nation states and all other things form, or all other bigger than 150 people groups form, which is good and bad. Obviously, the English language is a good thing to have for most people who speak it, because we can communicate with more people. But not all ideas are good ideas just because a lot of people believe in them.
Have you pulled on the rabbit hole? Have you gone down the rabbit hole of Dunbar's number when it comes to how money enabled part of that as well? Because I think Nick Szabo does a lot of work on this. I think he writes a piece called Shelling Out where he talks about this.
Yeah.
And this idea of, you know, those more primitive groups, there was less money in those groups because you could kind of know everybody and you guys could trade favors and do
things. You don't need money. In the smaller the group, the less you need money.
And
which is, by the way, why KYC laws are so stupid, because it defeats the very purpose of money. The purpose of money is to be able to trade with people you don't trust.
Yeah.
So why do you need to trust your customer and know stuff about your customer? The whole purpose of money is to rid yourself of that need.
Mm-hmm.
If you know the person, you don't need money. You can just trust them. So,
it's an interesting thought.
Penny dropped.
You can hold her like a baby, even if
you want. The penny finally dropped.
Oh my goodness! This idea of delayed reciprocal altruism—have you explored that idea at all?
Delayed what?
Delayed reciprocal altruism.
Delayed reciprocal altruism.
It's a thought from Nick Szabo's piece, Shelling Out. Why don't you take that and define that? I think it's actually mentioned in The Selfish Gene in Dawkins' book. I think it came from Dawkins' book.
Yeah. It's a fascinating idea.
Delayed reciprocal altruism refers to a behavior where an individual provides a benefit to another with the expectation that the favor will be returned at a later time, often in a different form or context. Unlike immediate reciprocity, the return benefit is not instantaneous and may involve a delay, requiring trust and social mechanisms to ensure repayment. This concept is rooted in evolutionary biology and game theory, particularly in Robert Trivers' work on reciprocal altruism, and is extended to economic and social systems like money. So this idea that money is itself a token of delayed reciprocal altruism, because you can't trust somebody to, you know, I scratch your back today and, you know, you watch Penny for me today and then next week I'll watch your dog, right? Like, you know, that's, but since we don't, if we didn't know each other, we would use money to represent that delayed reciprocal altruism.
The first chapter of The Inverse of Clown World is about a similar thing. And it's about game theory and in particular, the prisoner's dilemma. Which you're familiar with the maybe you should grok that too and do the TLDR on the prisoner's dilemma.
It's this idea of cooperation.
Well, it's
and
not
why you would cooperate or not cooperate, and how it kind of incentivizes discooperation, because you don't get the best outcome.
Well, if you play The Prisoner's Dilemma once, you should be egotistical. Mm-hmm. However, so a game, can you read that for me?
A game theory scenario where two individuals must choose to cooperate or defect without knowing the other's choice. Cooperation benefits both most if mutual, but defecting yields a higher individual payoff if the other cooperates. However, if both defect, both get a worse outcome. It illustrates the tension between individual self-interest and collective benefit, often leading to suboptimal results due to lack of trust or, scroll down a little bit more, Paul, or communication.
Yeah. So in the classic example of this dilemma, there are specific sentences that the prisoner gets for doing one thing or the other, and depending on what the other guy does. And in the individual, if you play the game once, it's better for you to try to cheat. But if you play the game over and over and over again, the more you play it, the more beneficial it becomes to cooperate and also to retaliate appropriately if the other guy falls out of line. And there's a competition by a mathematician called Axelrod who told people to try to come up with the ultimate solution of how to play the game. So they played the game in different ways. This is Prisoner's Dilemma played over and over again. And the tit-for-tat strategy, which was the winning mm-hmm. strategy, is basically just, yes, you should trust the other person mm-hmm. until they prove that you shouldn't.
Yeah.
And then you should distrust them the next time around, but then go back to trusting them again. And what's funny about that is reciprocal altruism. Mm. And it is the non-aggression principle. It is Rothbardian ethics, if you will. Mm-hmm. Eye for an eye or eye for two eyes, whatever the saying is. You should punish appropriately so that you don't get used. Uh-huh. You should... But the default state should be collaboration.
You know what's funny is that you say this, and I actually just drew parallels to, like, I feel like this is how Trump behaved with foreign policy. No, seriously. Like, he's you have all these actors in the world that are, you know, evil, you consider, yeah. you know, from whatever perspective you are, an evil actor, whether it's Russia or China or these different countries, Iran, for example.
China.
Like, you're seeing this with Russia now. It's like, there's been so many problems for so many years, but he's willing to, like, he's kind of like with Iran, like the missile strike, you know, we don't trust you, but now it's like, hey, now we're willing to deal. Let's, you know, it's kind of like that tit for tat strategy, but then there's a peace offering. And he does this with geopolitically with different countries, like North Korea is an example.
Yeah.
He did it with North Korea in his first term, where it was like, hey, you want to escalate. You're saying all this stuff. I'm going to say all this stuff. And then, hey, here's the olive branch afterwards. Like, let's, you know, it's an interesting thought, game theoretically.
It is interesting, but I personally believe that Trump knows fuck all about game theory.
I don't know if he knows anything about game theory at all. I think it's more of his intuition.
Yeah, exactly. It might come to him intuitively.
I think that's what it is. Yeah, he doesn't know anything about game theory.
No.
But, you know, I think it's an intuitive feel of, hey, you punch me, I punch you back, but then, hey, which is what that's his style. I mean, that is what you described is what...
But sometimes he also threatens without having been attacked first.
Like, sometimes he does he could do the punch.
The whole Greenland thing, for instance, was some...
And
it's hard to say when he's trolling and when he's...
What do you think is going to happen there? I mean, I know this is a side tangent.
I don't know. I don't care too
you don't
much
care,
about
no,
it.
I
don't really like to comment on politics because I think it's... all bad for the most part. you had the impossible choice of either choosing a socialist woman or a crony capitalist man, and the crony capitalist is probably the least worst choice.
Yeah,
but he's still gonna shitcoin and he's still gonna screw you over, but he might leave you alone a bit more. So
I'm allowed to have a bank account now, which is nice. So. I'll say that.
Yeah, you're allowed to use money that he can counterfeit by the click of a button or a simple phone call. So, congratulations.
Apparently he's mad right now. They're not letting him counterfeit. What's this Powell saying? We're not going to I'm not going to lower rates and do quantitative easing and all this other monkey business.
Yeah, I don't care that much. And it makes me sick when I see quote-unquote Bitcoiners cheer for a politician. I think that's very misguided. This whole thing is to allow us to not let these parasites rule our lives anymore. It's a way out of that. And I don't think, even though one side may be better than the other, I'd prefer if we didn't have to care about people who take our stuff at all.
Yeah, I mean, I'd prefer that. That sounds like a great idealistic world. Sadly, that's not the world we live in.
Well, you can live in that world to a larger or a smaller extent. And the more you hyper-Bitcoinize yourself, the less you have to deal with politicians and bureaucrats.
That would be nice.
No, it is nice. Yeah. You can actually do that.
Well, it's much easier said than done when you've got to rely.
Absolutely, but nothing easy is worth fighting for.
I'm with you, bro. It's just, you know, I've got tons of people that work for me, and they got families and kids and people to feed.
I know.
I got to be able to pay my electricity bills to huge electrical corporations so I can keep mining Bitcoin.
So do I. But
that's kind of what I'm
getting at. If I was to bet, I'd say you're more of a sovereign individual now than you were 10 years ago. Right?
No doubt. Yeah.
So. Which proves the thesis. Like, it's always directionally correct to give less of a fuck about what politicians say, regardless of color.
Yeah.
I guess the
way I think about it is Bitcoin's going to win at the end no matter what.
Yeah.
I'd just rather fight for both inside and outside the system.
Here's an interesting question. What's better for Bitcoin, a pro-Bitcoin politician or an anti-Bitcoin politician?
A pro-Bitcoin politician.
You think so?
Absolutely.
I do not.
Really?
I have my doubts.
Yeah.
Because if they can say it's now legal to run a node, then you run your node you're permitted by someone to run your node.
I mean, I think it just helps adoption grow faster. I think
but if adoption is paper Bitcoin adoption, it's not real adoption. So if people don't take measures into their own hands and actually do the work and run their nodes and do this and get their Bitcoins KYC free and do this shit properly, then it's not the freedom tool it was designed to be.
Yeah, I think unless it's at least here what I see in the first world, like if you're not living in an environment where you absolutely need it right now, like Africa and some South American countries, the way I've been able to I've run a Bitcoin meetup for almost a decade now. The way I've been able to kind of get people to that point is, hey, start with the easy KYC option and then learn about it.
Yeah.
And then as you go on your journey, then I can take you. Oh, Maddie, I've been coming to your meetup for 4 or 5 months now, and I've got a lot of Bitcoin keeps going up. And now, like, I don't know. I've been hearing this stuff about, you know, not about, you know, self-custody. What does this mean? You know, how do I do this? And then I can lead them down that path and help turn them.
I know. And
I
do believe that all roads lead to Bitcoin. However, I also believe that you can put up roadblocks by, for instance, by confusing it with crypto, which often leads to people being rugged by some fucking shitcoin, and then they don't study Bitcoin for the next decade because they say, oh, that's not for me, and they go back to their fiat slavery bullshit. So I think that's a roadblock. Crypto is a roadblock to hyper-Bitcoinization.
Oh, I'll just take the other side of that. I think it's just an adoption of teaching people about the technology. I mean,
It's not the technology that is the interesting aspect here. The interesting aspect is the agreement on a fixed set of rules. It's the communication aspect.
But using the idea of public and private key cryptography, that can be used for other things too, right? So getting people used to that, like you can get used to that on any kind of network or blockchain, et cetera. And that's kind of like a prerequisite. I mean, that's probably the biggest hurdle that I have when I get people coming to our meetups and they're, you know, they just don't understand. And it's like, hey, take the time to learn.
Okay. So that's the how, but I think the why is way more important than the how. Like if people understand the why and the problem it solves, which is counterfeiting.
Yeah.
And it's the biggest problem we ever had. We need inflation. It's the greatest lie ever told. If people understood that, we would live in a better world just because of the fact that they understood that they were being stolen from.
Yeah, that's
so I think
that's the core of what we teach for sure.
Important to emphasize on.
No doubt.
And only Bitcoin does that.
It's like so many people are living. It's like the Matrix, that scene where you're like got the red pill and the blue pill, and so many people are just kind of like don't even understand the difference. Like they're stuck in that blue pill. They're still in that like illusion.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that's massively what I encounter when people come to the meetup and start asking questions and doing stuff. But I always experience people that come that have been scammed or lost because they don't truly understand what they're interacting with, what they're doing, what public private key, like that it's a true bear asset.
Yeah.
I would say that's the biggest issue. Like, oh shit, but someone stole all my Bitcoin. I don't understand. So that's why like I'm.
But that's why I don't like introducing like public key, public private key cryptography as this, the important aspect of it, and that it works for these other blockchains, because that's missing the point. Other cryptocurrencies aren't bearer assets. They're only there because a committee decides that they are. They can be changed much, much more easily than Bitcoin can. Mm-hmm. Like Bitcoin is governed by the users and the nodes, and actually has a historical event that proved that to be true, which is the block size wars. And nothing of that kind exists in any other cryptocurrency.
I guess that what I'm talking about is the experience of the user interface of using a wallet, being able to send, receive, seed phrase.
Yeah, but if you
think, those things are,
if you
are
think
the same.
Send, receive buttons, you're using some other shit token. If you think that's the same thing, then you're completely missing the point. A Satoshi should be fucking sacred to everyone. It's not like anything else ever encountered by mankind. It's there forever. It's like, if this works, it's the greatest thing ever. Other shit is not. it's like confusing. So imagine you've designed the wheel. The wheel is the invention, the wheel works. Mm-hmm. And shitcoins, in my mind, are people trying to piggyback off of that the success of the wheel. And saying like, hey, have you tried constructing a wheel in a something other than a circular shape? Does the circle actually have to be the correct shape? What about this pentagonal wheel that I invented? Or what about this cubic wheel I invented? Like, in this case, like the discovery of America, like, yes, you can argue that both the Vikings and some Asian people discovered America before Christopher Columbus. But still, America exists today. It could only be discovered once. you can't. Me traveling to America doesn't automatically make me the discoverer of America. Like I think I have the quote here from. This is one of my most tweeted quotes. Absolute mathematical scarcity achieved by consensus in a sufficiently decentralized network was a discovery rather than an invention. It cannot be achieved again by a network of participants aware of this discovery, since the very thing discovered was resistance to replicability itself. And I think that's what intrigued me about Bitcoin in the first place. And that's what I struggled to find the words. I think this is the closest I got. But I think that's what people have such a hard time understanding, because they all underestimate how and underappreciate how big this thing is. It's also, by the way, why Mars coin won't work, why you can't do Bitcoin on Mars. because you couldn't do on-chain Bitcoin on Mars because you simply can't sync. When Mars is the closest, it's like 9 minutes away.
Yeah.
And so the center of hash will be closer to Earth, and therefore you can't sync as fast. So, but also, if people go to Mars and we terraform Mars and we start a cryptocurrency there, mm-hmm. that will be a shitcoin, because the people doing that will be aware of Bitcoin, meaning that they have insider information, and it will be impossible to reach sufficient decentralization. It would obviously be centralized. So this precious thing, we know that Bitcoin works the way it is. We know that it works the way things played out. We don't know if it would have worked if the parameters would have been any different, just as if you change the smallest cosmic constant of the universe wouldn't have existed at all. It's the same thing with Bitcoin. Like, you get a very different, if you take a swim in the ocean and you wipe yourself off with a towel afterwards, you get a very different result than if you do the opposite, if you use the towel first and go swimming afterwards, right? So the order in which these events played out plays a huge role in why Bitcoin works. We are here to observe it and study it, and trying to change it defeats its purpose.
How would money work on Mars?
That's a very good question. I mean, it would work like so. The definition of money is the common medium of exchange that people use in a certain geographical area. And I think Hans Hermann Hoppe's definition of it was like, or explanation of it was the best. Like it's the best insurance against uncertainty available to you. Mm-hmm. So the good that can provide you with that is most saleable. So you are most sure that someone else will accept it for your goods and services. And here people may say like, but hang on, I know almost no one who accepts Bitcoin, but if you pay them a premium, I'm sure they will accept Bitcoin. So that's what money is. And money is discovered on the free market, naturally. So that's what will happen on Mars too. If people start trading with one another, sooner or later, the market will figure out a good that is suitable for as a medium of exchange over time and space.
Mm. Interesting. Would it be like on the Lightning Network or some layer that periodically settles to the Bitcoin network on Earth?
Yeah, maybe there's a way to make a layer two work on Mars. Absolutely, uh-huh. Because you could. That's how it would have to work, simply because of the distance between Earth and Mars. Having said all that, there's a lot of other problems to solve first before we can even start thinking about money on Mars. Like we'll have to.
We're going down the philosophical rabbit hole. Yeah. I was just.
And this is an interesting question I got, by the way. If an alien race came to Earth and they had a version of Bitcoin with more proof of work. Uh-huh. Would we start using their coin or would we stick to our own?
That's a good question.
Super hard question. Like the odds that would happen at all are so small that you can not think about it. But it's an interesting mindfuck.
I have always thought that obviously I take the other side of some of these arguments, but I like optionality in my life. Whether one is a superior asset, like just because gold exists, like I don't think silver shouldn't exist. Obviously, one has a better for certain.
You can't do anything about that. Both exist.
Yeah, I just think it's free market. Like let the free market
absolutely. And money is just one good. It's not a consumer or producer good, but a good sui generis is the term for it. With meaning that it's only suitable as a medium of exchange over space and time. but it's one good amount. Like if you what's the price of money? Well, that depends on what you personally want to use money for. Mm-hmm. So if you're a big hot dog fans, a big hot dog fan, you may price the dollar in terms of how many hot dogs you can buy for a dollar. So that's the price of a dollar in hot dogs. And so these are just exchange ratios between prices are just exchange ratios between two different goods. And there will always be other goods than Bitcoin. It's just that it would be better for everyone if we use this as our primary medium of exchange because it would be easier to do economic calculation, everything divided by 24 million.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with that. It's a great, great explanation there. Final question I have for this. You mentioned something, you mentioned fear-based and love-based decision-making. Can you unpack that a little bit for our listeners?
It's the low time preference versus high time preference thing. So once again, if you're robbed of all your belongings and you find yourself in the Everglades, you are a scared person with a very high time preference. You need to find food and shelter and probably mosquito spray.
Yeah.
And something.
Watch out for the alligators.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the pythons.
And the cougars.
Yes, and the Native Americans and whatever.
They depends, do live out there.
Simple. Depends on what time you find yourself in. If you find yourself in the Everglades like 300 years or 500 years ago, other things to be scared of. Anyway, that's a state of fear. So this is to illustrate how a high time preference is connected to fear and a low time preference is connected to hope and love. because you can, if you have a lot of resources, if you know you're financially safe, or probably for a long extended period of time, you can think ahead further, meaning having a lower time preference, which allows you to provide more value to the people you love.
Interesting. Anything else you want to explore about symbiosis before we close out this chapter?
No. Bitcoin as a parasite is kind of a a parasite to kill all the other parasites.
A mind virus. But,
did you ever Bitcoin listen? As a vaccine against fiat.
Somebody, I can't remember. I think Geiswan did read this. It was like a Bitcoin as almost like a mycelium network or something.
Yeah, yeah. That's Brandon Quittam wrote that. Bitcoin is mycelia.
Yeah.
And there's a chapter on like Bitcoin as a life form in one of these books. I think it's in Sovereignty of Mathematics, one of the earliest. Like, how do you define a life form? And then you go down that rabbit hole.
That's quite
right. Figure out, yeah, that there is no consensus on what a life form is. There's no scientific consensus.
I feel like this is like we're like George Norrie, who does like the Middle of the Night podcast about aliens. You know what I'm talking about? Going down all these different rabbit holes.
I haven't heard of
him. You haven't heard him? No, he does the aliens and the UFOs, and he's always like, if you're driving and like 3 o'clock in the morning and like turn the radio on, it's like, welcome to George Norrie. We're talking, they just talking about all sorts of crazy stuff, but pretty cool.
So one question is, would aliens have something like Bitcoin?
Uh-huh.
But I think the more interesting question is, would aliens have something like OnlyFans?
Oh, man. Yeah. I don't know, man. I'm excited to find out one day. Maybe. See what's actually out there in the universe, you know?
Yeah.
All right. I think with that, we'll wrap up and we'll be back for episode 8 of our series.